brocade with a lavender velvet roquelaure over my shoulders. I had a new sword with a deep-carved silver handle and the usual heavy ornate buckles on my shoes, the usual lace, gloves, tricorn, and I came to the theatre in a hired carriage. But as soon as I paid the driver, I went back to the alley and opened the stage door, exactly as I used to do. At once the old atmosphere surrounded me, the smell of the thick grease paint and the cheap costumes full of sweat and perfume, and the dust. I could see a fragment of the lighted stage burning beyond the helter-skelter of hulking props, and hear bursts of laughter from the hall. A group of acrobats waited to go on at the intermezzo, a crowd of jesters in red tights, caps, and dagged collars studded with little gold bells. I felt dizzy and for a moment afraid. The place felt close and dangerous over my head, and yet it was wonderful to be inside it again. And a sadness was swelling inside me. No, a panic, actually. Lucina saw me, and she let out a shriek. Doors opened everywhere on the cluttered little dressing rooms. Renaud plunged toward me and pumped my hand. Where there had been nothing but wood and drapery a moment before, there was now a little universe of excited human beings, faces full of high colour and dampness, and I found myself drawing back from a smoking candelabra with the quick words, "My eyes! Put it out!" "Put out the candles. They hurt his eyes. Can't you see that?" Jeanette insisted sharply. I felt her wet lips open against my face. Everyone was around me, even the acrobats who didn't know me, and the old scene-painters and carpenters who had taught me so many things. Lucina said, "Get Nicky," and I almost cried no. Applause was shaking the little house. The curtain was being pulled closed from either side. At once the old actors were upon me, and Renaud was calling for champagne. I was holding my hands over my eyes as if like the basilisk. I'd kill every one of them if I looked at them. And I could feel tears, and knew that before they saw the blood in the tears, I had to wipe the tears away. But they were so close I couldn't get to my handkerchief, and with a sudden terrible weakness I put my arms around Jeanette and Lucina, and I pressed my face against Lucina's face. Like birds they were, with bones full of air, and hearts like beating wings, and for 1 second I listened with a vampire's ear to the blood in them. But that seemed an obscenity, and I just gave in to the hugging and the kissing, ignoring the thump of their hearts, and holding them, and smelling their powdered skin, and feeling again the press of their lips. "You don't know how you worried us," Renaud was booming, "and then the stories of your good fortune. Everyone, everyone!" he was clapping his hands. "It's Monsieur de Valois, the owner of this great theatrical establishment." And he said a lot of other pompous and playful things, dragging up the new actors and actresses to kiss my hand, I suppose, or my feet. I was holding tight to the girls as if I'd explode into fragments if I let them go, and then I heard Nicky, and knew he was only a foot away, staring at me, and that he was too glad to see me to be hurt any more. I didn't open my eyes, but I felt his hand on my face, then holding tight to the back of my neck. They must have made way for him, and when he came into my arms, I felt a little convulsion of terror. But the light was dim here, and I had fed furiously to be warm and human-looking, and I thought desperately, I don't know to whom I pray, to make the deception work. And then there was only Nicholas, and I didn't care. I looked up and into his face. How to describe what humans look like to us? I've tried to describe it a little, when I spoke of Nicky's beauty the night before as a mixture of movement and colour. But you can't imagine what it's like for us to look on living flesh. There are those billions of colours and tiny configurations of movement, yes, that make up a living creature on whom we concentrate. But the radiance mingles totally with the carnal scent. Beautiful. That's what any human being is to us, if we stop to consider it. Even the old and the diseased, the downtrodden that one doesn't really see in the street, they are all like that, like flowers ever in the process of opening, butterflies ever unfolding out of a cocoon. Well, I saw all this when I saw Nicky. And I smelled the blood pumping in him, and for one heady moment I felt love, and only love, obliterating every recollection of the horrors that had deformed me. Every evil rapture, Every new power with its gratification seemed unreal. Maybe I felt a profound joy, too, that I could still love, if I'd ever doubted it, and that a tragic victory had been confirmed. All the old mortal comfort intoxicated me, and I could have closed my eyes and slipped from consciousness carrying him with me, or so it seemed. But something else stirred in me, collecting strength so fast my mind raced to catch up with it and deny it even as it threatened to grow out of control, and I knew it for what it was, something monstrous and enormous and natural to me as the sun was unnatural. I wanted Nicky. I wanted him as surely as any victim I'd ever struggled with in the Ile de la Cité. I wanted his blood flowing into me, wanted its taste and its smell and its heat. The little place shook with shouts and laughter, Renaud telling the acrobats to get on with the intermezzo, and Lucina opening the champagne, but we were closed off in this embrace. The hard heat of his body made me stiffen and draw back, though it seemed I didn't move at all. And it maddened me suddenly that this one whom I loved, even as I loved my mother and my brothers, this one who had drawn from me the only tenderness I'd ever felt, was an unconquerable citadel, holding fast in ignorance against my thirst for blood when so many hundreds of victims had so easily given it up. This was what I'd been made for. This was the path I had been meant to walk. What were those others to me now? The thieves and killers I'd cut down in the wilderness of Paris. This was what I wanted, and the great, awesome possibility of Nicky's death exploded in my brain. The darkness against my closed eyelids had become blood-red, Nicky's mind emptying in that last moment, giving up its complexity with its life. I couldn't move. I could feel the blood as if it were passing into me, and I let my lips rest against his neck. Every particle in me said, "Take him. Spirit him out of this place and away from it, and feed on him, and feed on him until—" "Until what?" "Until he's dead." I broke loose and pushed him away. The crowd around us roared and rattled. Renaud was shouting at the acrobats who stood staring at these proceedings. The audience outside demanded the intermezzo entertainment with a steady rhythmic clap. The orchestra was fiddling away at the lively ditty that would accompany the acrobats. Bones and flesh poked and pushed at me. A shambles it had become, rank with the smell of those ready for the slaughter. I felt the all-too-human rise of nausea. Nicky seemed to have lost his equilibrium, and when our eyes met, I felt the accusations emanating from him. I felt the misery and, worse, the near despair. I pushed past all of them, past the acrobats with the jingling bells, and I don't know why I went forward to the wings instead of out the side door. I wanted to see the stage. I wanted to see the audience. I wanted to penetrate deeper into something for which I had no name or word. But I was mad in these moments. To say I wanted or I thought makes no sense at all. My chest was heaving, and the thirst was like a cat clawing to get out. And as I leaned against the wooden beam beside the curtain, Nicky, hurt and misunderstanding everything, came to me again. I let the thirst rage. I let it tear at my insides. I just clung to the rafter, and I saw in one great recollection all my victims, the scum of Paris, scraped up from its gutters, and I knew the madness of the course I'd chosen, and the lie of it, and what I really was. What a sublime idiocy that I had dragged that paltry morality with me, striking down the damned ones only, seeking to be saved in spite of it all. What had I thought I was, a righteous partner to the judges and executioners of Paris, who strike down the poor for crimes that the rich commit every day? Strong wine I'd had, in chipped and broken vessels. And now the priest was standing before me at the foot of the altar, with a golden chalice in his hands, and the wine inside it was the blood of the Lamb. Nicky was talking rapidly. "Lestat, what is it? Tell me," as if the others couldn't hear us. "Where have you been? What's happened to you? Lestat?"
"Get on that stage," Renaud thundered at the gaping acrobats.
They trotted past us into the smoky blaze of the footlamps and went into a chain of somersaults. The orchestra made its instruments into twittering birds. A flash of red harlequin sleeves, bells jangling, taunts from the unruly crowd. "Show us something! Really show us something!" Lucina kissed me, and I stared at her white throat, her milky hands. I could see the veins in Jeanette's face, and the soft cushion of her lower lip coming ever closer. The champagne, splashed into dozens of little glasses, was being drunk. Some speech was issuing forth from Renault about our partnership, and how tonight's little farce was but the beginning, and we would soon be the grandest theatre on the boulevards. I saw myself decked out for the part of Lelio, and heard the ditty I had sung to Flaminia on bended knee. Before me, little mortals flip-flopped heavily, and the audience was howling as the leader of the acrobats made some vulgar movement with his hind end. Before I even meant to do it, I had gone out on the stage. I was standing in the very center, feeling the heat of the footlights, the smoke stinging my eyes. I stared at the crowded gallery, the screened boxes, the rows and rows of spectators to the back wall, and I heard myself snarl a command for the acrobat to get away. It seemed the laughter was deafening, and the taunts and shouts that greeted me were spasms and eruptions, and quite plainly behind every face in the house was a grinning skull. I was humming the little ditty I'd sung as Lelio, no more than a fragment of the part, but the one I'd carried in the streets afterwards with me. Lovely, lovely Flaminia, and on, the words forming meaningless sounds. Insults were cutting through the din. "On with the performance, and you're handsome enough, now let's see some action." From the gallery someone threw a half-eaten apple that came thumping just past my feet. I unclasped the violet roquelaure and let it fall. I did the same with the silver sword. The song had become an incoherent humming behind my lips, but mad poetry was pounding in my head. I saw the wilderness of beauty and its savagery the way I'd seen it last night when Nicky was playing, and the moral world seemed some desperate dream of rationality that in this lush and fetid jungle had not the slightest chance. It was a vision, and I saw, rather than understood, except that I was part of it, natural as the cat with her exquisite and passionless face digging her claws into the back of the screaming rat. "Handsome enough is this grim reaper," I half uttered, "who can snuff all these brief candles, every fluttering soul sucking the air from this hall." But the words were really beyond my reach. They floated in some stratum, perhaps, where a god existed who understood the colours patterned on a cobra's skin and the eight glorious notes that make up the music erupting out of Nicky's instrument, but never the principle, beyond ugliness or beauty, "Thou shalt not kill." Hundreds of greasy faces peered back at me from the gloom, shabby wigs and paste jewels and filthy finery, skin like water flowing over crooked bones. A crew of ragged beggars whistled and hooted from the gallery, humpback and one eye, and stinking underarm crutch, and teeth the colour of the skull's teeth you sift from the dirt of the grave. I threw out my arms, I crooked my knee, and I began turning as the acrobats and dancers could turn, round and round on the ball of one foot, effortlessly going faster and faster, until I broke, flipping over backwards into a circle of cartwheels and then somersaults, imitating everything I had ever seen the players at the fairs perform. Applause came immediately. I was agile as I'd been in the village, and the stage was tiny and hampering, and the ceiling seemed to press down on me, and the smoke from the footlights to close me in. The little song to Flaminia came back to me, and I started singing it loudly as I turned and jumped and spun again, and then, gazing at the ceiling, I willed my body upwards as I bent my knees to spring. In an instant I touched the rafters, and I was dropping down gracefully, soundlessly to the boards. Gasps rose from the audience. The little crowd in the wings was stunned. The musicians in the pit, who had been silent all the while, were turning to one another. They could see there was no wire. But I was soaring again to the delight of the audience, this time somersaulting all the way up, beyond the painted arch again to descend in even slower, finer turns. Shouts and cheers broke out over the clapping, but those backstage were mute. Nicky stood at the very edge, his lips silently shaping my name. "It has to be trickery, an illusion." The same avowals came from all directions. People demanded agreement from those around them. Renault's face shone before me for an instant with gaping mouth and squinting eyes. But I had gone into a dance again, and this time the grace of it no longer mattered to the audience. I could feel it, because the dance became a parody, each gesture broader, longer, slower than a human dancer could have sustained. Someone shouted from the wings and was told to be still, and little cries burst from the musicians and those in the front rows. People were growing uneasy and whispering to one another, but the rabble in the gallery continued to clap. I dashed suddenly towards the audience, as if I meant to admonish it for its rudeness. Several persons were so startled they rose and tried to escape into the aisles. One of the horn players dropped his instrument and climbed out of the pit. I could see the agitation, even the anger in their faces. What were these illusions? It wasn't amusing them suddenly. They couldn't comprehend the skill of it, and something in my serious manner made them afraid. For one terrible moment, I felt their helplessness. And I felt their doom. A great horde of jangling skeletons, snared in flesh and rags, that's what they were. And yet their courage blazed out of them. They shouted at me in their irrepressible pride. I raised my hands slowly to command their attention, and very loudly and steadily I sang the ditty to Flaminia, my lovely Flaminia. A dull little couplet spilling into another couplet, and I let my voice grow louder and louder until suddenly people were rising and screaming before me. But louder still I sang it, until it obliterated every other noise, and in the intolerable roar I saw them all, hundreds of them, overturning the benches as they stood up, their hands clamped to the sides of their heads, their mouths were grimaces, toneless screams, pandemonium. Shrieks, curses, all stumbling and struggling towards the doors. Curtains were pulled from their fastenings. Men dropped down from the gallery to rush for the street. I stopped the horrid song. I stood watching them in a ringing silence, the weak, sweating bodies straining clumsily in every direction. The wind gusted from the open doorways, and I felt a strange coldness over all my limbs, and it seemed my eyes were made of glass. Without looking, I picked up the sword and put it on again, and hooked my finger into the velvet collar of my crumpled and dusty roquelaure. All these gestures seemed as grotesque as everything else I had done, and it seemed of no import that Nicholas was trying to get loose from two of the actors who held him in fear of his life as he shouted my name. But something out of the chaos caught my attention. It did seem to matter, to be terribly, terribly important, in fact, that there was a figure standing above in one of the open boxes who did not struggle to escape, or even move. I turned slowly and looked up at him, daring him, it seemed, to remain there. An old man he was, and his dull grey eyes were boring into me with stubborn outrage, and as I glared at him, I heard myself let out a loud, open-mouthed roar. Out of my soul it seemed to come, this sound. It grew louder and louder until those few left below cowered again with their ears stopped, and even Nicholas, rushing forward, buckled beneath the sound of it, both hands clasped to his head. And yet the man stood there in the loge, glowering, indignant and old and stubborn, with furrowed brows under his grey wig. I stepped back and leapt across the empty house, landing in the box directly before him. And his jaw fell in spite of himself, and his eyes grew hideously wide. He seemed deformed with age, his shoulders rounded, his hands gnarled. But the spirit in his eyes was beyond vanity and beyond compromise. His mouth hardened, and his chin jutted, and from under his frock coat he pulled his pistol, and he aimed it at me with both hands. "Lestat!" Nicky shouted. But the shot exploded, and the ball hit me with full force. I didn't move. I stood as steady as the old man had stood before, and the pain rolled through me and stopped, leaving in its wake a terrible pulling in all my veins. The blood poured out. It flowed as I have never seen blood flow. It drenched my shirt, and I could feel it spilling down my back, but the pulling grew stronger and stronger, and a warm, tingling sensation had commenced to spread across the surface of my back and chest. The man stared, dumbfounded. The pistol dropped out of his hand. His head went back, eyes blind, and his body crumpled as if the air had been let out of it, and he lay on the floor. Nicky had raced up the stairs and was now rushing into the box. A low, hysterical murmuring was issuing from him. He thought he was witnessing my death. And I stood, still hearkening to my body in that terrible solitude that had been mine since Magnus made me the vampire. And I knew the wounds were no longer there. The blood was drying on the silk vest, drying on the back of my torn coat. My body throbbed where the bullet had passed through me, and my veins were alive with the same pulling, but the injury was no more. And Nicholas, coming to his senses as he looked at me, realized I was unharmed, though his reason told him it couldn't be true. I pushed past him and made for the stairs. He flung himself against me, and I threw him off. I couldn't stand the sight of him. The smell of him. "Get away from me," I said. But he came back again, and he locked his arm around my neck. His face was bloated, and there was an awful sound coming out of him. "Let go of me, Nicky," I threatened him. If I shoved him off too roughly, I'd tear his arms out of the sockets, break his back. Break his back. He moaned, stuttered. And for one harrowing split second, the sounds he made were as terrible as the sound that had come from my dying animal on the mountain, my horse, crushed like an insect into the snow. I scarcely knew what I was doing when I pried loose his hands. The crowd broke, screaming when I walked out onto the boulevard. Renaud ran forward in spite of those trying to restrain him. "Monsieur!" he grabbed my hand to kiss it, and stopped, staring at the blood. "Nothing, my dear Renaud," I said to him. Quite surprised at the steadiness of my voice and its softness. But something distracted me as I started to speak again, something I should hearken to, I thought vaguely. Yet I went on. "Don't give it a thought, my dear Renaud," I said. "Stage blood. Nothing but an illusion. It was all an illusion. A new kind of theatrical. Drama of the grotesque. Yes, the grotesque." But again came that distraction, something I was sensing in the melee around me, people shuffling and pushing to get close, but not too close, Nicholas stunned and staring. "Go on with your plays," I was saying, almost unable to concentrate on my own words. "Your acrobats, your tragedies, your more civilized theatricals, if you like." I pulled the banknotes out of my pocket and put them in his unsteady hand. I spilled gold coins onto the pavement. The actors darted forward fearfully to gather them up. I scanned the crowd around for the source of this strange distraction. What was it? Not Nicholas in the door of the deserted theatre, watching me with a broken soul. No. Something else, both familiar and unfamiliar, having to do with the dark. "Hire the finest mummers," I was half-babbling. "The best musicians, the great scene-painters." More banknotes. My voice was getting loud again, the vampire voice. I could see the grimaces again and the hands going up, but they were afraid to let me see them cover their ears. "There is no limit, no limit to what you can do here." I broke away, dragging my roquelaure with me, the sword clanking awkwardly because it was not buckled right. Something of the dark. And I knew when I hurried into the first alleyway and started to run what it was that I had heard, what had distracted me. It had been the presence, undeniably, in the crowd. I knew it for one simple reason. I was running now in the back streets faster than a mortal can run, and the presence was keeping time with me. And the presence was more than one. I came to a halt when I knew it for certain. I was only a mile from the boulevard, and the crooked alley around me narrow and black as any in which I had ever been. And I heard them before they seemed quite purposefully and abruptly to silence themselves. I was too anxious and miserable to play with them. I was too dazed. I shouted the old question. "Who are you? Speak to me." The glass panes rattled in the nearby windows. Mortals stirred in their little chambers. There was no cemetery here. "Answer me, you pack of cowards. Speak if you have a voice, or once and for all get away from me." And then I knew, though how I knew I can't tell you, that they could hear me, and they could answer me if they chose. And I knew that what I had always heard was the irrepressible evidence of their proximity and their intensity, which they could disguise. But their thoughts they could cloak, and they had. I mean, they had intellect, and they had words. I let out a long, low breath. I was stung by their silence, but I was stung 1,000 times more by what had happened, and as I'd done so many times in the past, I turned my back on them. They followed me. This time they followed, and no matter how swiftly I moved, they came on. And I did not lose the strange, toneless shimmer of them until I reached the Place de Grève and went into the Cathedral of Notre Dame. I spent the remainder of the night in the cathedral, huddled in a shadowy place by the right wall. I hungered for the blood I'd lost, and each time a mortal drew near I felt a strong pulling and tingling where the wounds had been. But I waited. And when a young beggar woman with a little child approached, I knew the moment had come. She saw the dried blood and became frantic to get me to the nearby hospital, the Hôtel Dieu. Her face was thin with hunger, but she tried to lift me herself with her little arms. I looked into her eyes until I saw them glaze over. I felt the heat of her breasts swelling beneath her rags. Her soft, succulent body tumbled against me, giving itself to me as I nestled her in all the blood-stained brocade and lace. I kissed her, feeding on her heat as I pushed the dirty cloth away from her throat, and I bent for the drink so skillfully that the sleepy child never saw it. Then I opened, with careful, trembling fingers, the child's ragged shirt. This was mine, too, this little neck. There weren't any words for the rapture. Before, I'd had all the ecstasy that rape could give, but these victims had been taken in the perfect semblance of love. The very blood seemed warmer with their innocence, richer with their goodness. I looked at them afterwards, as they slept together in death. They had found no sanctuary in the cathedral on this night. And I knew my vision of the garden of savage beauty had been a true vision. There was meaning in the world, yes, and laws, and inevitability, but they had only to do with the aesthetic. And in this savage garden, these innocent ones belonged in the vampire's arms. 1,000 other things can be said about the world, but only aesthetic principles can be verified. And these things alone remain the same. I was now ready to go home, and as I went out in the early morning I knew that the last barrier between my appetite and the world had been dissolved. No one was safe from me now, no matter how innocent, and that included my dear friends at Renault's, and it included my beloved Nicky. 13. I wanted them gone from Paris. I wanted the playbills down, the doors shut. I wanted silence and darkness in the little rat-trap theatre where I had known the greatest and most sustained happiness of my mortal life. Not 12 innocent victims a night could make me stop thinking about them, could make this ache in me dissolve. Every street in Paris led to their door. And an ugly shame came over me when I thought of my frightening them. How could I have done that to them? Why did I need to prove to myself with such violence that I could never be part of them again? No. I'd bought Renault's. I'd turned it into the showcase of the boulevard. Now I would close it down. It was not that they suspected anything, however. They believed the simple, stupid excuses Roger gave them, that I was just back from the heat of the tropical colonies, that the good Paris wine had gone right to my head, plenty of money again to repair the damage. God only knows what they really thought. The fact was they went back to regular performances the following evening, and the jaded crowds of the Boulevard du Temple undoubtedly put upon the mayhem 12 sensible explanations. There was a queue under the chestnut trees. Only Nicky was having none of it. He had taken to heavy drinking and refused to return to the theatre or study his music any more. He insulted Roger when he came to call. To the worse cafes and taverns he went, and wandered alone through the dangerous night-time streets. Well, We have that in common, I thought. All this Roger told me as I paced the floor a good distance from the candle on his table, my face a mask of my true thoughts.
Money doesn't mean very much to the young man, monsieur, he said. The young man has had plenty of money in his life, he reminds me. He says things that disturb me, monsieur. I don't like the sound of them.
Roger looked like a nursery rhyme figure in his flannel cap and gown, legs and feet naked because I had roused him again in the middle of the night and given him no time to put on his slippers, even, or to comb his hair.
What does he say? I demanded. He talks about sorcery, monsieur. He says that you possess unusual powers. He speaks of La Voisin and the Chambre Ardente, an old case of sorcery under the Sun King, the witch who made charms and poisons for members of the court.
Who would believe that trash now? I affected absolute bewilderment.
The truth was, the hair was standing up on the back of my neck. Monsieur, he says bitter things, he went on, that your kind, as he puts it, has always had access to great secrets. He keeps speaking of some place in your town called the Witch's Place.
My kind?
That you are an aristocrat, monsieur, Roger said. He was a little embarrassed. When a man is angry, as Monsieur de Lanfond is angry, these things come to be important. But he doesn't whisper his suspicions to the others. He tells only me. He says that you will understand why he despises you. You have refused to share with him your discoveries. Yes, monsieur, your discoveries. He goes on about La Voisin, about things between heaven and earth for which there are no rational explanations. He says he knows now why you cried at the witch's place.
I couldn't look at Roger for a moment.
It was such a lovely perversion of everything. And yet it hit right at the truth. How gorgeous and how perfectly irrelevant.
In his own way, Nicky was right.
Monsieur, you are the kindest man, Roger said.
Spare me, please.
But Monsieur de Lanfond says fantastical things, things he should not say even in this day and age. That he saw a bullet pass through your body that should have killed you.
The bullet missed me, I said. Roger, don't go on with it. Get them out of Paris. All of them.
Get them out? He asked.
But you put so much money into this little enterprise. So what? Who gives a damn? I said. Send them to London, to Drury Lane. Offer Renault enough for his own London theatre. From there they might go to America. Saint-Domingue, New Orleans, New York. Do it, monsieur. I don't care what it takes. Close up my theatre and get them gone.
And then the ache will be gone, won't it? I'll stop seeing them gathered around me in the wings, stop thinking about Lelio, the boy from the provinces who emptied their slop buckets and loved it.
Roger looked so profoundly timid.
What is it like, working for a well-dressed lunatic who pays you triple what anyone else would pay you, to forget your better judgment?
I'll never know. I'll never know what it is like to be human in any way, shape, or form again. As for Nicholas, I said, you're going to persuade him to go to Italy, and I'll tell you how.
Monsieur, even persuading him to change his clothes would take some doing.
This will be easier. You know how ill my mother is. Well, get him to take her to Italy. It's the perfect thing. He can very well study music at the conservatories in Naples, and that is exactly where my mother should go.
He does write to her. Is very fond of her.
Precisely. Convince him she'll never make the journey without him. Make all the arrangements for him. Monsieur, you must accomplish this. He must leave Paris. I give you till the end of the week, and then I'll be back for the news that he's gone. It was asking a lot of Roger, of course, but I could think of no other way. Nobody would believe Nicky's ideas about sorcery. That was no worry. But I knew now that if Nicky didn't leave Paris, he would be driven slowly out of his mind. As the nights passed, I fought with myself every waking hour not to seek him out, not to risk one last exchange. I just waited, knowing full well that I was losing him forever, and that he would never know the reasons for anything that had come to pass. I, who had once railed against the meaninglessness of our existence, was driving him off without explanation, an injustice that might torment him to the end of his days.
Better that than the truth, Nicky. Maybe I understand all illusions a little better now.
And if you can only get my mother to go to Italy, if there is only time for my mother still. Meantime, I could see for myself that Renault's house of thespians was closed down. In the nearby café I heard talk of the troops' departure for England, so that much of the plan had been accomplished. It was near dawn on the eighth night when I finally wandered up to Roger's door and pulled the bell. He answered sooner than I expected, looking befuddled and anxious in the usual white flannel nightshirt.
"I'm getting to like that garb of yours, monsieur," I said wearily. "I don't think I'd trust you half as much if you wore a shirt and breeches and a coat."
"Monsieur," he interrupted me, "something quite unexpected."
"Answer me first. Renault and the others went happily to England?"
"Yes, monsieur. They're in London by now, but—"
"And Nicky, gone to my mother in the Auvergne? Tell me I'm right. It's done."
"But, monsieur," he said. And then he stopped. And quite unexpectedly I saw the image of my mother in his mind. Had I been thinking, I would have known what it meant. This man had never, to my knowledge, laid eyes upon my mother. So how could he picture her in his thoughts? But I wasn't using my reason. In fact, my reason had flown.
"She hasn't—" "You're not telling me that it's too late," I said.
"Monsieur, let me get my coat," he said inexplicably. He reached for the bell. And there it was, her image again, her face, drawn and white and all too vivid for me to stand it. I took Roger by the shoulders.
"You've seen her. She's here."
"Yes, monsieur, she's in Paris. I'll take you to her now. Young de Lenfant told me she was coming. But I couldn't reach you, monsieur. I never know where to reach you. And yesterday she arrived." I was too stunned to answer. I sank down into the chair, and my own images of her blazed hot enough to eclipse everything that was emanating from him. She was alive, and she was in Paris. And Nicky was still here, and he was with her. Roger came close to me, reached out as if he wanted to touch me. "Monsieur, you go ahead while I dress. She is in the Ile Saint-Louis, 3 doors to the right of Monsieur Nicholas. You must go at once." I looked up at him stupidly. I couldn't even really see him. I was seeing her. There was less than an hour before sunrise, and it would take me 3/4 of that time to reach the tower. Tomorrow night, I think I stammered. That line came back to me from Shakespeare's Macbeth. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. "Monsieur, you don't understand. There will be no trips to Italy for your mother. She has made her last journey in coming here to see you." When I didn't answer, he grabbed hold of me and tried to shake me. I'd never seen him like this before. I was a boy to him, and he was the man who had to bring me to my senses. "I've gotten lodgings for her," he said. "Nurses, doctors, all that you could wish. But they aren't keeping her alive. You are keeping her alive, monsieur. She must see you before she closes her eyes. Now forget the hour and go to her. Even a will as strong as hers can't work miracles." I couldn't answer. I couldn't form a coherent thought. I stood up and went to the door, pulling him along with me.
"Go to her now," I said, "and tell her I'll be there tomorrow night."
He shook his head. He was angry and disgusted, and he tried to turn his back on me. I wouldn't let him.
"You go there at once, Roger," I said. "Sit with her all day, do you understand, and see that she waits for me to come. Watch her if she sleeps. Wake her and talk to her if she starts to go, but don't let her die before I get there."
Part 3. Viaticum for the Marquise. 1. In vampire parlance, I am an early riser. I rise when the sun has just sunk below the horizon and there is still red light in the sky. Many vampires don't rise until there is full darkness, and so I have a tremendous advantage in this, and in that they must return to the grave a full hour or more before I do. I haven't mentioned it before because I didn't know it then, and it didn't come to matter until much later. But the next night, I was on the road to Paris when the sky was on fire. I'd clothed myself in the most respectable garments I possessed before I slipped into the sarcophagus, and I was chasing the sun west into Paris. It looked like the city was burning. So bright was the light to me, and so terrifying, until finally I came pounding over the bridge behind Notre Dame into the Ile Saint-Louis. I didn't think about what I would do or say, or how I might conceal myself from her. I knew only I had to see her, and hold her and be with her while there was still time. I couldn't truly think of her death. It had the fullness of catastrophe, and belonged to the burning sky. And maybe I was being the common mortal, believing if I could grant her last wish, then somehow the horror was under my command. Dusk was just bleeding the light away when I found her house on the quays. It was a stylish enough mansion. Roger had done well, and a clerk was at the door waiting to direct me up the stairs. Two maids and a nurse were in the parlour of the flat when I came in. "Monsieur de L'Enfant is with her, monsieur," the nurse said. "She insisted on getting dressed to see you. She wanted to sit in the window and look at the towers of the cathedral, monsieur. She saw you ride over the bridge." "Put out the candles in the room, except for one," I said, "and tell Monsieur de L'Enfant and my lawyer to come out." Roger came out at once, and then Nicholas appeared. He, too, had dressed for her, all in brilliant red velvet with his old fancy linen and his white gloves. The recent drinking had left him thinner, almost haggard. Yet it made his beauty all the more vivid. When our eyes met, the malice leapt out of him, scorching my heart. "The Marquise is a little stronger today, monsieur," Roger said, "but she's hemorrhaging badly. The doctor says she will not—" He stopped and glanced back at the bedroom. I got it clear from his thought. "She won't last through the night."
"Get her back to bed, monsieur, as fast as you can."
"For what purpose do I get her back to bed?" I said. My voice was dull, a murmur. "Maybe she wants to die at the damned window. Why the hell not?"
"Monsieur,"
Roger implored me softly. I wanted to tell him to leave, with Nicky. But something was happening to me. I went into the hall and looked towards the bedroom. She was in there. I felt a dramatic physical change in myself. I couldn't move or speak. She was in there, and she was really dying. All the little sounds of the flat became a hum. I saw a lovely bedroom through the double doors, a white-painted bed with gold hangings, and the windows draped in the same gold, and the sky in the high panes of the windows with only the faintest wisps of gold cloud. But all this was indistinct and faintly horrible, the luxury I'd wanted to give her, and she about to feel her body collapse beneath her. I wondered if it maddened her, made her laugh. The doctor appeared. The nurse came to tell me only one candle remained, as I had ordered. The smell of medicines intruded and mingled with a rose perfume. And I realized I was hearing her thoughts. It was the dull throb of her mind as she waited, her bones aching in her emaciated flesh, so that to sit at the window even in the soft velvet chair with the comforter surrounding her was almost unendurable pain. But what was she thinking beneath her desperate anticipation? Lestat, Lestat, and Lestat, I could hear that. But beneath it? Let the pain get worse, because only when the pain is really dreadful do I want to die. If the pain would just get bad enough so that I'd be glad to die, and I wouldn't be so frightened, I want to be so terrible that I'm not frightened.
"Monsieur," the doctor touched my arm, "she will not have the priest come."
"No, she wouldn't." She had turned her head towards the door. If I didn't come in now, she would get up, no matter how it hurt her, and come to me. It seemed I couldn't move, and yet I pushed past the doctor and the nurse, and I went into the room and closed the doors. Blood scent. In the pale violet light of the window she sat, beautifully dressed in dark blue taffeta, her hand in her lap and the other on the arm of the chair, her thick yellow hair gathered behind her ears so that the curls spilled over her shoulders from the pink ribbons. There was the faintest bit of rouge on her cheeks. For one eerie moment she looked to me as she had when I was a little boy. So pretty! The symmetry of her face was unchanged by time or illness, and so was her hair. and a heart-breaking happiness came over me, a warm delusion that I was mortal again, and innocent again, and with her, and everything was all right, really, truly, all right. There was no death, and no terror, just she and I in her bedroom, and she would take me in her arms. I stopped. I'd come very close to her, and she was crying as she looked up. The girdle of the Paris dress bound her too tightly, and her skin was so thin and colourless over her throat and her hands that I couldn't bear to look at them, and her eyes looked up at me from flesh that was almost bruised. I could smell death on her. I could smell decay. But she was radiant, and she was mine. She was as she'd always been, and I told her so silently, with all my power, that she was lovely as my earliest memory of her when she had had her old fancy clothes still, and she would dress up so carefully, and carry me on her lap in the carriage to church. And in this strange moment, when I gave her to know this, how much I cherished her, I realized she heard me, and she answered me that she loved me and always had. It was the answer to a question I hadn't even asked, and she knew the importance of it. Her eyes were clear, unentranced. If she realized the oddity of this, that we could talk to each other without words, she gave no clue. Surely she didn't grasp it fully. She must have felt only an outpouring of love. "Come here so I can see you," she said, "as you are now." The candle was by her arm on the windowsill, and quite deliberately I pinched it out. I saw her frown, a tightening of her blonde brows, and her blue eyes grew just a little larger as she looked at me, at the bright silk brocade, and the usual lace I'd chosen to wear for her, and the sword on my hip with its rather imposing jewelled hilt. "Why don't you want me to see you?" she asked. "I came to Paris to see you. Light the candle again." But there was no real chastisement in the words. I was here with her, and that was enough. I knelt down before her. I had some mortal conversation in mind that she should go to Italy with Nicky, and quite distinctly, before I could speak, she said, "Too late, my darling. I could never finish the journey. I've come far enough." A clamp of pain stopped her, circling her waist where the girdle bound it, and to hide it from me, she made her face very blank. She looked like a girl when she did this, and again I smelt the sickness in her, the decay in her lungs, and the clots of blood. Her mind became a riot of fear. She wanted to scream out to me that she was afraid. She wanted to beg me to hold on to her and remain with her until it was finished, but she couldn't do this, and to my astonishment, I realized she thought I would refuse her, that I was too young and too thoughtless to ever understand. This was agony. I wasn't even conscious of moving away from her, but I'd walked across the room. Stupid little details embedded themselves in my consciousness. Nymphs playing on the painted ceiling, the high gilt door handles and the melted wax in brittle stalactites on the white candles that I wanted to break off and crumple in my hand. The place looked hideous, overdressed. Did she hate it? Did she want those barren stone rooms again? I was thinking about her as if there were tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. I looked back at her, her stately figure holding to the windowsill. The sky had deepened behind her, and a new light, the light of house lamps and passing carriages and nearby windows, gently touched the small inverted triangle of her thin face. "Can't you talk to me?" she said softly. "Can't you tell me how it's come about? You've brought such happiness to all of us." Even talking hurt her. "But how does it go with you? With you?" I think I was on the verge of deceiving her, of creating some strong emanation of contentment with all the powers I had. I'd tell mortal lies with immortal skill. I'd start talking and talking and testing my every word to make it perfect. But something happened in the silence. I don't think I stood still more than a moment, but something changed inside of me. An awesome shift took place. In one instant I saw a vast and terrifying possibility, and in that same instant, without question, I made up my mind. It had no words to it, or scheme, or plan. And I would have denied it had anyone questioned me at that moment. I would have said, no, never. Farthest from my thoughts. What do you think I am? What sort of monster? And yet the choice had been made. I understood something absolute. Her words had completely died away. She was afraid again, and in pain again, and in spite of the pain she rose from her chair. I saw the comforter slip away from her, and I knew she was coming towards me, and that I should stop her. But I didn't do it. I saw her hands close to me, reaching for me, and the next thing I knew she had leapt backwards, as if blown by a mighty wind. She had scuffed backwards across the carpet and fallen past the chair against the wall, but she grew very still quickly, as though she willed it, and there wasn't fear in her face, even though her heart was racing. Rather, there was wonder, and then a baffled calm. If I had thoughts at that moment, I don't know what they were. I came towards her just as steadily as she had come towards me, gauging her every reaction. I drew closer until we were as near to each other as we had been when she leapt away. She was staring at my skin and my eyes, and quite suddenly she reached out again and touched my face. Not alive! That was the horrifying perception that came from her silently. Changed into something, but not alive! Quietly I said no. That was not right. And I sent a cool torrent of images to her, a procession of glimpses of what my existence had become. Bits, pieces of the fabric of the nighttime Paris, the sense of a blade cutting through the world soundlessly. With a little hiss she let out her breath. The pain balled its fist in her, opened its claw. She swallowed, sealing her lips against it, her eyes veritably burning into me. She knew now these were not sensations, these communications, but that they were thoughts. How then? She demanded. And without questioning what I meant to do, I gave her the tale, link by link, the shattered window through which I'd been torn by the ghostly figure who had stalked me at the theatre, the tower, and the exchange of blood. I revealed to her the crypt in which I slept, and its treasure, my wanderings, my powers, and above all the nature of the thirst, the taste of blood and the feel of blood, and what it meant for all passion, all greed to be sharpened in that one desire, and that one desire to be satisfied over and over with the feeding and the death. The pain ate at her, but she no longer felt it. Her eyes were all that was left of her as she stared at me. And though I didn't mean to reveal all these things, I found I had taken hold of her, and was turning so that the light of the carriages crashing along the quay below fell full on my face. Without taking my eyes from her, I reached for the silver candelabra on the windowsill, and lifting it, I slowly bent the metal, working it with my fingers into loops and twists. The candle fell to the floor. Her eyes rolled up into her head. She slipped backwards and away from me, and as she caught the curtains of the bed in her left hand, the blood came up out of her mouth. It was coming from her lungs, in a great silent cough. She was slipping down on her knees, and the blood was all over the side of the draped bed. I looked at the twisted silver thing in my hands, the idiotic loops that meant nothing, and I let it drop. And I stared at her. Her struggling against unconsciousness and pain, and wiping her mouth suddenly in sluggish gestures, like a vomiting drunk, on the bedclothes, as she sank, unable to support herself, to the floor. I was standing over her. I was watching her, and her momentary pain meant nothing in light of the vow that I was speaking to her now. No words again. Just the silent thrust of it, and the question, more immense than could ever be put into words. Do you want to come with me now? Do you want to come with me into this now? I hide nothing from you, not my ignorance, not my fear, not the simple terror that if I try I might fail, I do not even know if it is mine to give more than once, or what is the price of giving it, but I will risk this for you, and we will discover it together, whatever the mystery and the terror, just as I've discovered alone all else." With her whole being she said, "Yes." "Yes," she screamed aloud suddenly, drunkenly, the voice maybe that had always been her voice, yet one that I had never heard. Her eyes closed and tightened, and her head turned from the left and to the right. "Yes!" I leant forward and kissed the blood on her open lips. It sent a zinging through all my limbs, and the thirst leapt out for her and tried to transform her into mere flesh. My arms slipped around her light little form, and I lifted her up and up until I was standing with her against the window, and her hair was falling down behind her, and the blood came up in her out of her lungs again, but it didn't matter now. All the memories of my life with her surrounded us. They wove their shroud around us and closed us off from the world, the soft poems and songs of childhood, and the sense of her before words, when there had only been the flicker of the light on the ceiling above her pillows, and the smell of her all around me, and her voice silencing my crying, and then the hatred of her, and the need of her, and the losing of her behind a thousand closed doors, and cruel answers, and the terror of her, and her complexity, and her indifference, and her indefinable strength. And jetting up into the current came the thirst, not obliterating, but heating every concept of her, until she was flesh and blood, and mother, and lover, and all things beneath the cruel pressure of my fingers and my lips, everything I had ever desired. I drove my teeth into her, feeling her stiffen and gasp, and I felt my mouth grow wide to catch the hot flood when it came. Her heart and soul split open. There was no age to her, no single moment. My knowledge dimmed and flickered, and there was no mother any more, no petty need and petty terror. She was simply who she was. She was Gabrielle. And all her life came to her defense. The years and years of suffering and loneliness, the waste in those damp, hollow chambers to which she'd been condemned, and the books that were her solace, and the children who devoured her and abandoned her, and the pain and disease, her final enemy, which had in promising release pretended to be her friend. Beyond words and images there came the secret thudding of her passion, her seeming madness, her refusal to despair. I was holding her off her feet, my arms crossed behind her narrow back, my hand cradling her limp head, and I was groaning so loud against her with the pumping of the blood that it was a song in time with her heart. But the heart was slowing too quickly. Her death was coming, and with all her will she pumped against it, and in a final burst of denial I pushed her away from me and held her still. I was almost swooning. The thirst wanted her heart. It was no alchemist, the thirst. And I was standing there with my lips parted, and my eyes glazed, and I held her far, far away from me, as if I were two beings, the one wanting to crush her, and the one to bring her to me. Her eyes were open and seemingly blind. For a moment she was in some place beyond all suffering, where there was nothing but sweetness, and even something that might be understanding, but then I heard her calling to me by name. I lifted my right wrist to my mouth, and slashed the vein and pushed it against her lips. She didn't move as the blood spilled over her tongue. "Mother, drink!" I said frantically, and pushed it harder, but some change had already commenced. Her lips quivered, and her mouth locked to me, and the pain whipped through me suddenly encircling my heart. Her body lengthened, tensed, her left hand rising to grasp my wrist as she swallowed the first spurt, and the pain grew stronger and stronger so that I almost cried out. I could see it as if it were molten metal coursing through my vessels, branching through every sinew and limb, yet it was only her pulling, her sucking, her taking the blood out of me that I had taken from her. She was standing now on her own feet, Her head, barely leaning against my chest, had a numbness crept over me, with a pulling, burning through the numbness, and my heart thundered against it, feeding the pain as it fed her pulling with every beat. Harder and harder she drew, and faster, and I felt her grip tighten, and her body